Introduce Stephen L., our AA speaker tonight from Redondo Beach, California. Thank you.
Steve Lamb, alcoholic.
Steve.
It's good to be here. It's good to be sober. I want to thank Jeff for inviting me out to share. It's always an honor and a privilege to share in Alcoholics Anonymous. And my God, you are a motley crew. And I say that with love. I feel right at home. I mean, it's just, I really appreciate being invited to the marathon meeting up here in Vancouver. I really enjoy that, and I'm hoping I don't need Depends to make it through the rest of this meeting, but I'm glad to be here. I'm glad to be here. And frankly, I'm glad to be anywhere. About 2.5 years ago, on May 22nd of 2016, I got shot. And I've been shot before. I was in the Army for 13 and a half years. I really appreciated the veterans thing that you guys did. That was cool. But when I got shot before, it was a through and through. It was, as my team sergeant said, it was a flesh wound. It was nothing to be overly concerned about. But a couple years ago, I was right outside a little town called Badger in Northern California. And it's right next to Sequoia National Park. And I was up there at the Seven Circles Retreat Center. And we just had breakfast. And I was sitting on my bed. You know, I was minding my own business. That's my story. I'm sticking to it. I wouldn't do anything wrong, okay? And the guy above me decided to clear his Glock 9mm. And he missed a really critical step, and he jacked around through the chamber. He discharged the round. He fired it. It went through the floor, which was the ceiling above me, and it entered my chest right above my heart and buried itself in my sternum. It'll get your attention. You know, and I, like I said, I've been shot before, so I'm checking for an exit wound. I don't have an exit wound, and it's going to sound a little strange, but I put my finger in the entry wound to see if I could find where the round was, and I couldn't because it was buried underneath my sternum, but I didn't have a sucking chest wound. I wasn't bleeding out. I was in a bit of shock, but, it didn't look like it was going to be, deadly, and the guy from upstairs comes running downstairs, and he's like, "What happened?" I'm like, "You shot me. That's what happened, right?" And I got to tell you, he starts freaking out, absolutely freaking out. And my sobriety date is July 27th, 1996, so I've been sober 22 years and some change. At the time, I was just coming up on 20 years. And if you'd have done this to me about 20 years prior to that, something bad would have happened, okay? And the amazing thing about Alcoholics Anonymous is I'm concerned about this guy. Because he's freaking out. Because I realize I'm not going to die, but, And so I go in the bathroom, and I get a towel, and I put it over the wound, and I tell him he's got to take me down to the hospital down in Visalia, little town Visalia, which is normally about an hour away. We got there in about a half an hour. The guy's driving like crazy. I remember looking over at him and telling him, "Hey, I really don't want to survive this gunshot wound and die in a car wreck, so if you could just..." ramp it down a bit, I would really appreciate that. And we roll up to the Cahuilla Medical Center emergency room, and we go in, and we're in the emergency room, and they always ask you if they can help you. I said, "Yeah." I said, "What's your problem?" And I'm thinking, these people aren't that bright. I mean, I got a bloody towel right over my chest, but I said, "Well, I've been shot." Now, when you tell them you've been shot, man, you go right to the head of the line. I mean, there's people in the waiting room, and they've got some broken bones and some sniffles and whatever, but you go, they bring out the gurney. There's 15, 16 people working on me. They do an x-ray to find out where the round was buried in my chest, and they get a cardiologist in there, and they're hooking me up, and they're looking at all this stuff, and as soon as they realize that the round was buried underneath my sternum and it wasn't going anywhere, now I'm like the freak show. Everybody in the hospital wants to come by and look at this guy, he got shot. Can you believe this? This is bizarre, right? Well, I'm glad I could entertain you, And so the cardiologist tells me, it looks like it's going to be okay, but we're gonna leave the round there. We can't actually go in there. We have to crack your chest open to get to it. It doesn't look like it's going anywhere. But we did an EKG on you, and you've got this thing. We call it an atrial flutter. It's kind of like an atrial fibrillation. Your heart is spasming. Now, so it's supposed to beat. And there's a little extra spasm in there, and we don't really like that. That can, if you stroke, you could have a problem. So when you go back down to your home in the Los Angeles area, I want you to go check in with your cardiologist, get that checked out. All right, no problem. So they let me go after a couple of days. I go home, and I see my cardiologist, Dr. Carlson. He hooks me up to an EKG. He says, yeah, you got this atrial flutter thing. I said, but look, we've got a procedure. It doesn't always work, but, it corrects a lot of these problems. And, you've seen in the movie how they take the paddles and they shock a guy. Well, that's barbaric. We're not going to do that. We're gonna tape these pads to your chest. And then what we're going to do is we're going to hit you with a shot of electricity. Bam! And it'll stop your heart. And we'll leave it stopped for 5, 6, 7 seconds, and then we're going to hit you with another shot of electricity. That'll start your heart, and, hopefully it'll be in sync. So I'm like, Doc, that sounds a lot like you're going to kill me. And he goes, no, we don't like to look at it that way. And by the way, I'm going to be there. It's a control procedure. We're in a hospital. And, there's going to be an anesthesiologist there, and he's going to give you something that'll make you comfortable before the procedure. So I'm an alcoholic. I go from you're going to kill me to I'm going to get comfortable, Now, it's not that I haven't been comfortable in my almost 20 years in Alcoholics Anonymous up to this time, but I haven't been that kind of comfortable in a long time. And I'm figuring, okay, this is a free pass. My sponsor will be okay with it. I'm good with it. I'm like, all right, Doc, let's hook me up. Let's do this thing, right? So we wait a few weeks. I go in. I got the little hospital gown on. They put the pads on me, and I got an IV in me, and Dr. Carlson's there. And I see the anesthesiologist coming. He's got a syringe of comfortable, right? I'm watching him. I'm tracking him the whole way across the room. He gets up in front of me, and he's talking to me, and he injects this solution into my IV. And the next thing I know, I'm talking to Dr. Carlson. Dr. Carlson says, how you doing? I said, I'm good. I'm ready. He goes, no, we already did it. I'm like, well, that ain't right. No, you told me I was going to get comfortable because, I'm thinking, I'm waiting for the, count back from 100, 100, 99, and what I found out was the anesthesiologist gave me this substance called propofol, which is what they gave Michael Jackson. They just gave me the correct dose. And I'll tell you, these anesthesiologists, they're really good now. I mean, you're here, and then you're here. You don't even go there. I got to tell you, it's disappointing, frankly, But the best part of this story is not that, and the best part of the story is that when I was shot, I was on an AA retreat. Just let that sink in for a little bit. It gets better. I was leading the retreat. I had given a talk the night before on unity, which I thought was rather compelling, but I might have missed one guy. But the coup de grace is the guy that shot me, I sponsor him. Yeah, it's a real crowd pleaser. And I have noticed, by the way, that the Al-Anons seem to be very gleeful at that concept. I don't know what's with that, but the reality is I sponsored him then, I sponsor him now. I've made a lot of mistakes before I got sober, after I got sober. He screwed up. He didn't try to do it, and I've had a couple of these cardio versions. They didn't really take. I had three of them over time, and recently I had something called a cryoablation, where they go up in your leg and they basically go into your heart and they freeze parts of your chamber and they superheat other parts to basically kill these. They call them electrical clouds, and supposedly it's worked. I hope it's worked. But one of the things I've had to learn over the last couple of years is I'm under a doctor's care. I got to follow the doctor's advice, which is annoying. I like to argue. I like to negotiate. I don't want to do certain things. But it's really, really good to be here. And I got to tell you, when I first got to Alcoholics Anonymous, it was July 27th, 1996. I got popped for a DUI. I used to drive drunk all the time, but this particular time I got popped for a DUI, and I don't know what they do up here in the Vancouver-Portland area, but the judges down in Southern California, they sentence you to AA. And I got sentenced to go to 6 AA meetings in 6 months. I, too, thought it was excessive. And so I held out till I had about 5 weeks left to do six AA meetings. And because I suffer from this thing called delusion, I'm thinking, man, that's more than one a week. Who could possibly fit that into my active social calendar, you know? And I've been sober since the first day I went. And it wasn't by design. It wasn't by plan. I didn't really care for you when I first got here. But one of the things I've looked back on and reflected on is I realized that you were telling my story. You know, and I'm the kind of guy, my wife sends me out to get milk and I come back 3 days later. You know, I meet people. You know, we drink beer, we shoot tequila. We engage in time travel, which I found out later is blacking out. And I come back after 3 days, I'm like, hey, baby, I got the milk. She's not impressed. She's not impressed at all, you know. And I don't like to spend a lot of time on my drinking, but there's some new people here. So just to give you a snapshot of what it was like before I got sober, I'm a trial lawyer by trade. So before I got sober, the way I would prepare for trial is I would get the case file. I would either put it on the kitchen table or the conference room table, and I would get out beer and tequila. And I would drink beer, and I would shoot tequila, because beer is like a basic food group, and tequila is an outstanding accelerant. It's just an excellent accelerant. And I would never even open the case file. That's not necessary. I would just leave it there. And just stick with me, okay? And what would happen is, in my mind's eye, everything would become clear. I would go into the courtroom in my mind's eye, and I would pick a jury. And it was just a real, I could tell it was a good jury. And I would make an opening statement, which was really quite good. You had to be there. I mean, it was really good. And I would examine and cross-examine all the witnesses, and all the evidence that I wanted excluded would be excluded, and all the good evidence would come in, and then I would make a closing argument, which was just, I'm not bragging, but really, it was stupendous. It was stupendous. It was great, right? And the jury would retire, and after a brief period of time, they would come back, and they would render a verdict in favor of my client, all while drinking beer and shooting tequila. It was like magic. It was like magic. Now, the only problem with this process is when you drink the way I do, you drink until it's done with you. You drink until you pass out. So I set 4 or 5 alarm clocks at 2 to 3 minute intervals all around the room, because otherwise I won't wake up the next morning, right? So after the third or fourth one go off the next morning, I turn them off, I go take a shower, I shave, I put on a suit and tie. I'm not drunk as I was last night, but I'm inebriated. And I'm going to court, and the particular morning that I'm thinking about, I have a case for a client, Brian. He's from New York. He's a high finance guy. This is a commercial case. It's other people's money. We've been trying to resolve it for a while, but we've been unsuccessful. We got to pick a jury. So we're in court, and Judge Lax, who's the judge over this particular case, calls my client, Brian, and the other guy up, and he says, look, you've been to settlement conferences and mediations. This is just about money. You're going to tie my courtroom up for 3, 4, 5, maybe 6 weeks. I would really appreciate it if, while the lawyers are picking a jury, you two would try to resolve this case. So I'm picking a jury, and we're going through this process. Around 11:30, Brian's really excited. He tells the judge we've retained a settlement, and it's very favorable to Brian. It's several $1 million in his favor. The judge is thrilled because he's going to get rid of us. He puts us on the record, and he dismisses us. And Brian looks at me. It's around 11:30, and he looks at me and goes, you know, this is great. We've been working on this case for about 3 years, and I know it's early. It's before noon, but it seems like we should celebrate. Do you want to have a drink? And I'm thinking, what a country. I totally want to have a drink. This is great. And he's buying. So we go to the Grand Avenue Bar. And the Grand Avenue Bar is remarkably on Grand Avenue and 5th in downtown Los Angeles. It's right next to the Biltmore Hotel, which is a very nice hotel. And the bar is a really nice bar. Now, I drank primarily at home. I drank frequently in bars. But the type of bars that I went to, they had a certain ambiance. They usually would have some sawdust on the floor. And usually what I like is this faint eau de urine scent, which somehow motivates me to drink. I don't know what it is. But this is a bar with a bartender with a suit and a tie on, and, you know, he's snazzy, and Brian's a high finance guy from New York, and we walk into the bar, and Brian has him get this dusty bottle of cognac down from the back of the bar. And the bartender takes it down. He puts it on the counter. He takes out 2 large brandy snifters, and he plops them on the bar, and he pours 1 fluid ounce into each of the brandy snifters. Now, when you put an ounce in a shot glass of tequila, you can see it. It's clear. It's apparent. And if you're a good bartender, you fill it up so much that I got to lean over and, you know, because you don't want to spill any of the nectar of the gods, right? But when you put a fluid ounce into a brandy snifter, I mean, you see it go in. You know it's in there, but it's sad and lonely and desperate, you know? And what happens is you get this kind of amber shimmering on the side of the glass, and I'm kind of looking over there to see it, and Brian, you know, he can tell I'm a bit confused. He says, you've never had cognac before. I'm like, well, no. I'm not stupid. He's buying. I'm drinking. But no, I've never had cognac before. Because look, there's a whole process to this. There's a protocol. It's really important. And what you want to do is you want to take that brandy snifter and you want to cup it in the base of the palm of your hand so that the palm of your hand makes contact with the glass. That will go through the glass. That will heat up the cognac. That will warm up the cognac, and that will release the bouquet. I'm thinking, this is totally unnecessary with tequila, okay, but whatever, right? And then he says, you want to twirl it around in the glass, you want to bring it up to your nose, you don't want to snort it, you don't want to sniff it, you just want to allow the bouquet to waft into your nostrils. And I'm thinking, we're going to drink this stuff, right? You know, and he's like, then when you've really appreciated the bouquet, you want to bring it up to your lips, don't drink it, don't sip it, just drape the cognac across your palate. So by now, I'm just kind of rocking back and forth, you know, and my eye is twitching, and I've got fuzzy teeth. You know how when you've had a drink, and you need a drink, and you can smell the drink, and your teeth are just fuzzy and itchy, and I'm, and Brian says, okay, pay attention. And he does it. And the guy's like right out of GQ. He's a beautiful guy. He's beautiful, beautiful. And he says, okay, Lamb, it's your turn. I'm like, my turn. It's my turn. I love my turn. It's my turn. I'm ready for my turn, right? So I get the brandy snifter, and I twirl it around because I'm thinking, like, well, you know, how warm does it need to be, right? You know, so I bring it up, and I'm not gonna snort it, but I think maybe a little nose hit, but nothing really big, right? You know, I get it up, and bam, and I shoot it like tequila, right? No thought process. It's gone. You know, I looked at Brian. Brian looked at me. I don't know who was more surprised, you know, and he's... He's like, yeah, that's like $100 a shot. What are you doing? So I just reverted to the alcoholic anthem. I looked down at my shoes and I went, well, I'm sorry. Can I have a beer? And he's a nice guy, so he's buying me beer. I'm going to have 2-3 beers. I'm not where I was the night before, but I'm getting there. But he's generous. He's gracious. And he goes, look, pay attention. We're going to do it again. I'm like, I got it. I can do this. I can drink like a gentleman, right? Bam! It's gone again, right? So now he gives me that look like, hey man, that ain't right, you know? And he's never read the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, but he knows in that instant that I am bodily and mentally different than he is. And he is shaking his head, and he's like, wow, you know, it's almost 1 o'clock. I think I'm going to go to the bathroom, come back, finish my cognac, and then it's almost 4 in New York. I'll give him a call, tell him the good news. He leaves, right? I'm drinking my beer, minding my own business. I see his cognac. That's right. Bam, I drink that, right? You know, I go in the bathroom, I come out of the bathroom, and he's arguing with a bartender because someone's stolen his cognac. I remind him, I'm an experienced trial attorney. I'm going around, I'm cross-examining people, you know, but Brian's not stupid. He's now what we call an ex-client. He's leaving, right? I'm working for a major international law firm. This is a big client. This is I'm gonna have to go back. I'm gonna have some explaining to do. This is bad. But I'm an alcoholic. I'm thinking, okay, great. I'm gonna drink the way I want to drink. Sit down, get a table, beer, tequila. This cognac is way too complicated. Beer, tequila. I'm drinking beer, shooting tequila. Drinking beer, shooting tequila. And I don't mean to be gross and disgusting, but this is part of my story. What happens is a lot of people. You know, I forget to do things like eat. That's not my story. I like a light snack, maybe a couple cheeseburgers, pizza, nothing really big, right? You know, and then I'm drinking beer and shooting tequila, and what I do is I start farting. I know it's not an impressive skill set, but if you're wasted, you got to be there, you know? And I got this whole little symphonic harmony going, this purple haze thing going on, and people are looking at me like I'm crazy, and I suffer from delusion, and there's two women over on the side of the bar, and they're looking at me, and I'm looking at them, and I'm thinking... We're going to get there, sir, but that's not quite. You're getting ahead of the story. But I'm thinking, oh, yeah. They want me, right? I mean, who wouldn't, right? You know? And so and we're getting to it in a second. So what happens is I go to be particularly melodic, and I lift my leg, and I miscalculate. Yeah. 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 Oh, like it's never happened to any of you. Come on. And I'll tell you, I mean, the key is that you got to act cool, like nothing's going on, man. Like this is all part, yeah, no problem. And you don't want to lower that leg. You want to keep that one leg. You don't want to make contact with the seat. Then what happens is you just slide out on one cheek, just casually slide out on one cheek. And I go up and I go to the bathroom. I take my jacket off, take my pants off. I take my underwear off and I clean myself up and I put my pants and my jacket back on. And I'm out at the sink, you know, rinsing my drawers out like any good American would, right? Yeah. Yeah, right. Guy walks in, looks at me just like that, sir. He's like, what? I'm like, hey, man, what's your problem? Don't you practice hygiene? Come on, you know? And I get him kind of cleaned up. I wring him out. I go back in the stall. I take my pants off, take my jacket off. I put my drawers back on. Oh, yes, ma'am, I do, because I got some class. I got my pants on. I got my jacket on, and I'm walking out. And because I suffer from a delusion, I'm thinking, well, that didn't go half bad, you know? And then the second thought is, like, these are kind of damp. I'm feeling kind of sexy. Who knows what'll happen, right? Woo, you know? And finally, they throw me out of the bar. I drive home. I park in the driveway. My driveway, your driveway. I'm an equal opportunity driveway kind of guy. I don't really care where it is. And then I go through the front door. The front door is a double-wide garage door. There's no way I'm getting a key in the door. I don't park in the garage. I just open it. And I walk in, and there's a doorway that goes up into the living room, and there's three steps, and right next to the steps, there's a fridge. And in the fridge, there's beer. And I don't care if I've been out for 3 hours or 3 days, I get a beer. I'm an alcoholic. I drink no matter what. I get a beer. I drink the beer. I go upstairs. I put it on the nightstand, or maybe it falls on the floor. I get into bed with my lovely wife, and on a good night, after 2 or 3 or 4 hours, I get up, I stagger around, I maybe pee in the hall, or I go in the closet, pee in her boots, or something like that. And on a bad night, I wet the bed. Oh, yeah, when I got here, I was a vision for you. There's no question about it. Right? And none of that got me to come to AA. None of that got me to come to AA. You know, it annoyed the hell out of you, but I don't really like people, okay? And you're a price that I'm willing to pay so that I can continue to drink. And I'm still amazed that I stopped when I got here. It was just kind of amazing. And so that's, you know, that's, and by the way, when I first got here, everybody was telling puking stories. We are a puking group. I mean, it's projectile, it's colored, and I never puked. I remember when I finally got a sponsor, talking to Michael about it, I said, well, you know, I don't know, you know, I don't know, these people, I never puked. I don't know if these people really drank the way I drank. I don't know if I'm an alcoholic of that variety. He goes, oh, you're right. You would just crap your pants with reckless abandon and alarming regularity. No, you're special. You need to call New York because we've been waiting for you, you know. I later found out we've got a doctor in our group, and he explained to me that when you drink a certain amount of alcohol, the body will expel it through one of three orifices. And it is not particular about which orifice it expels it from, you know. So I get here, and I'm going to meetings. And there are people in the meetings that are telling me things like meetings, meeting makers make it, you know, 90 meetings in 90 days, all of which is good advice. But there are other people that are saying, you know, really, you should do the steps. And there's a program in Alcoholics Anonymous that is the steps, and it's found in something called the Big Book. And the point of the exercise is to find, develop, and maintain a conscious contact with the God of your understanding so that you can live and move and have your being in the world out there without drinking or using any party favors. And we have something called a sponsor, which will guide you through that process. But I'm not drinking, you know? I don't want to overreact here. You know, I don't want to get over sober, right? And because there's some lovely women in the morning meetings that are telling me, you know, hey, honey, just don't leave before the miracle. So I'm waiting for the miracle. I'm not doing anything, but I'm just waiting for the miracle. The miracle's not happening. People are talking about being restored to sanity. I feel like I'm going nuts. You know, I got about 100 days. I'm stark raving sober, and I'm coming to meetings, and I there's a lot of white noise going on in my head. I'm a jackass at work. I'm a jackass at home. I'm a jackass at meetings. The old-timers are looking at me. They're going, Lamb, just sit in the corner, and for God's sakes, don't talk to any newcomers because they still have hope. You know, give them a chance, right? You know, and finally, I went on a business trip. I went back. I'm in Pittsburgh. I'm doing some depositions. I'm getting ready for a trial, and I was supposed to be there all week, but I got done around Wednesday or Thursday midday. I go back to the hotel room. Inside the hotel room, I've got an honor bar. An honor bar. I'm a newcomer. I don't have any honor, but I have this mini fridge. I've got the key to it. It doesn't have everything I want and need in it, but it's a really good start. And I want a drink. I want a drink. And there's a, I love the big book and I love the 12 and 12, but one of the things that my sponsor had me listen to when I was newly sober was a series of talks by a guy named Chuck Chamberlain. And in 1975, he gave a retreat down in Palo Mesa. And after he passed away, one of his sponsees put it in a book form. It's called A New Pair of Glasses. It's not AA-approved literature. It's just one man's story. But in that book, there's a drawing. There's only one drawing. It's a simple drawing. What Chuck does is he draws a circle. And inside the circle, he puts all the people, plants, and animals in the universe inside the circle of life. And then Chuck puts life, good, God, whatever your concept of a higher power is, inside the circle of life. And then he draws a stick man, separate and apart, outside the circle of life. And that's Chuck, and that's me. And because you're here, you know, on a Saturday night after 9 o'clock, I'm assuming it's you. And what separates us is a thin line that Chuck identifies as ego, or conscious separation from God. In the 11th step, we're trying to get conscious contact, but I'm new, I've got conscious separation. The 12 and 12 calls it anxious apartness. It's this feeling of separation that every member of Alcoholics Anonymous I've ever worked with has. It's the grand illusion. It's the big delusion. It's not true, but I can't see that until I've worked through the steps. Because the reality is we're all inside the circle of life. You can't be anywhere else but inside the circle of life. And the better reality is there isn't even an edge to the circle of life, but I can't see that when I'm new. And I want a drink, and I'm opening and shutting this honor bar. I'm opening and shutting them. I like inventory it. I arrange the domestics, the imports, you know, just to be ready in case, right? You know, and I'm looking at it, and it's talking to me, so I'm trying to distract myself. I'm watching television. I'm flipping back and forth between religious television and porno. Religious television and... You too, huh, Mike? Yeah, and the bad news is I'm getting confused as to who's doing what on what station, but that's a personal problem. But I don't drink. And you could call it the dumb luck of the alcoholic. Norm Alpe used to call it seconds and inches. I now believe it's the grace of God, but I would not have called it that then. I get in a car, I go down, go out to the airport, fly home to Los Angeles. I get up the next morning. I've had time to think on the plan. Plane. I'm a newcomer, so I've got a newcomer plan, and I get out a kit bag, because like I said, I was in the Army for 13 and a half years. I went in as an infantry officer. I went through airborne school. I went through ranger school. When I was in Korea, I got recruited to go through special forces training. I went through SF training, selection and assessment. I was a Green Beret. They sent me over to Beirut in 1983. I commanded an A-team over there. They eventually sent me to law school. I did my last 6 years as a JAG in the Army, and when I got out, I had acquired some stuff, primarily when I was in SF. I had some weapons, some demo, and 13 passports. And I had them in a kit bag. We call it a go bag. And in 1993, when I got out of the Army, I didn't think of this as stealing. I just thought this might come in handy one day, you know? I mean, it's just, you know, and today's the day. And I'm not going to go Columbine with the weapons or the demo, and I've since gotten rid of everything, but I need these passports because my newcomer plan, which I'm thinking is brilliant, is this. I'm going to take my blue tourist passport, my legitimate passport that the government has given me, I'm going to fly to British Columbia, okay? It's important to leave the country on your name. Then I'm going to start flipping passports and identities. I'm going to head over to Europe for a bit. After a couple weeks, I'll come back. I'll be in British Columbia. Steve Lamb will cease to exist. Now, I got a wife and I got a kid, but I don't consult with them because it's a career change and really they're not involved in this process, right? And so my plan then is once I get back to British Columbia, I'm going to head down to Costa Rica. I've got some former Army associates of mine that are down there. They're doing some kind of interesting marketing and distribution in Costa Rica. And that's my newcomer plan. So I lay all this stuff out, and the 13 passports I should have turned in 1993, they're all current. They have not expired. But my blue tourist passport has expired. So I'm just beside myself. I can't believe it because I can't execute this seemingly brilliant plan. Now, the pathetic thing about this is this. This is 1996. This is pre-9/11. I could have flown to British Columbia on my driver's license back then, you know. And it's a chuckle's okay, sir, but it ain't that funny. I mean, you had to be there, okay? I mean, because I'm almost in tears, right? You know, and it's bizarre. I mean, the Army sent me to law school. They sent me to get an LLM, a Master of Laws. I'm licensed to practice before the Supreme Court of the United States. But that particular morning, I did not have the synaptic capacity to tie my shoes. I was just unbelievable. So I went to a meeting, and I was assigned a sponsor. My grand sponsor, whom I didn't much care for, assigned me a sponsor, Michael. And God, it was weird. It really was, because what he was talking about sponsorship in the meeting, and I went up to him after the meeting and I said, "I heard you talking about sponsorship, Jim, and I think it's time for me to interview for a sponsor." Well, because what I heard was find somebody who has what you want. Well, how can you do that if you don't interview? I got a complex set of social issues. Not anybody can sponsor this, right? But Jim looks at me and he goes, "Man, you are pathetic." He takes me outside. He introduces me to Michael. He says, "Michael, Steve, Michael, sponsor, go with God." He walks away laughing. And I'm thinking, this is not funny. It's not even slightly amusing, right? But, you know, he's walking away, and Michael's all excited. He's reaching in his pocket. He's getting out a piece of paper. He's writing down stuff because he's been delivered a newcomer. And for years, I thought Jim was trying to help me. Now that I've sponsored so many guys, I realize that is not the case. Jim was trying to help Michael. Jim sponsored Michael. Michael was spinning out of control. He saw me and he said, "Here, play with this." You know? This guy will distract you from you, you know? And because I got to tell you, like, when I was in the hospital in Visalia at Kaweah, I get calls all the time. I got calls this afternoon. I got a call then from a guy that I sponsored. And he says, "How you doing?" They'll always ask you. They don't care. They don't want to know how you're doing, right? I said, "Well, I'm not doing too good. I got shot." "Really? Really? What? Well, are you going to be okay?" "Well, I think, okay. Well, let me tell you what she did now." Because they want to go right to their problem du jour, right? And when I first started sponsoring guys, this annoyed me. I now realize it's a divine distraction, you know? It's getting out of self and into God. You know, Brant talked a lot about suffering. You can only suffer when you're thinking of yourself. If you're thinking of someone else, you're not suffering. You're in action. And it's a blessing. It doesn't feel like it at the time, but it's a blessing. So I'm sitting outside the meeting, and Michael is reaching his pocket. He gives me his phone number, his address, and he asked me a couple questions I like to ask the people I sponsor. He says, "Do you have a big book?" And I'm looking at him. I'm not saying this, but I'm thinking, yeah, I gotta be. I'm never reading with you. I got a big book. I'm never reading with you. Nope. But what I said was, "Yeah, I got a big book." He says, "Do you have a 12 and 12? And again, I'm thinking, "Yeah, I got a 12 and 12. He's younger than me. I don't even have a story. I got a complex set of social. This is bizarre. I'm not going to do this, right?" And by the way, he has a lazy, wandering eye. He doesn't even focus on you. It's just kind of up and to the right. And like, I got to tell you, when we did the inventory, before we did sexual misconduct inventory, he said, "We're going to do sexual misconduct inventory, and before we do that, we should say a prayer, and let's invite God into the room." And then he looked up and to the right. I followed him. I don't know. I don't know what's going on, right? Yeah. So he's going through this stuff with me, and then he says, "Good, you're going to need both your big book and your 12 and 12. Be at my house Monday night at 6:30. And everything in me said, "No, no, no." And I heard myself say, "Okay." And as soon as I said okay, he turned around and he left because he knew what he was dealing with, right? And if you're new, that was my first step in recovery. I always knew I was powerless over alcohol. I told you what happens when I can't even go out for milk, you know? I can't, it's crazy. I cannot control and enjoy my drinking. There's no way. But my life is unmanageable. Even though I'm crapping my pants with reckless abandon and alarming regularity, it takes a while for me to realize that my life is unmanageable in the face of all evidence to the contrary. But now when I finally asked this guy, even in the lame way that I did, now I've really done a first step. And we did more. We read through the book, and he, you know, God, he had me, you know, Jeff and I were talking about this earlier. I showed up at his house because he said, "I want you to read through the doctor's opinion. You know, start at the preface, the forewords, read through the doctor's opinion, and then read the first chapter in the 12 and 12, and we'll talk about it when we get." Oh, it's fine. I go over to his house. He tells me a little bit about himself. I tell him about myself. And then he says, "Okay, start reading to me." I'm like, "Well, I read it. We can talk about it." "No," he says, "I want you to read it to me." I'm like, "What? Really? You know, I'm a lawyer." "Yeah, I know. Read to me." So I'm reading, and as I'm reading, he's saying, did you do that? Did you feel that way? Do you identify with that? Do you agree with that? And we're having a conversation. What does that word mean? I'm a lawyer. I don't need to. I just make crap up. I don't care. I'm making it. And you know what? You know what the SOB does? He pulls out a dictionary, right? The guy's fact-checking me, right? That's not what it means. I'm like, oh, okay, right? And then he'd read a little bit, and then I'd read a little bit, and we'd have a discussion. We're in the doctor's opinion. Are you one of these five types of alcoholics? I'm like, oh, yeah, I think I'm the guy who's essentially normal in every respect except for the effect it has on alcohol. He kind of chuckles and says, well, you might find yourself in a couple other areas later on, but let's move on. I now realize that I'm probably at least three different categories. But the point is, I found myself in the book. You know, when we talked about Jim the car salesman, when we talked about, you know, Fred the accountant, when we talked about the jaywalker, I could relate, I could identify. And that's, we got to a step, we worked the step, we got to a prayer, we said the prayer, and I got to tell you, it saved my life. And if you knew, I was absolutely convinced it wouldn't work. And I've been around for a little while, there's a lot of people that have been around for a lot longer than me, but I've never met anybody that's come into Alcoholics Anonymous, looked up at one of these posters on the wall, and seen the 12 steps and gone, oh, thank God. You know, I've been waiting my whole life for this, you know? You know, Jeff, will you take me through the steps? No. We're like, seriously? Really? Okay, and it looks like confession, right? I mean, what does that have to do with anything? And by the way, you know, this 8 and 9, this making amends and paying the money back, I understand that technically it's their money. I got it. I got that. But I've been hanging on to it for a long time. It really feels, and then what good is it going to do me to give them back their money when it feels like my money? I don't understand this, right? You know, and the weird thing about the steps from my perspective is they are ridiculous and they make absolutely no sense looking forward. They only make sense after you've done them. I have no idea why that is, but I remember how complicated I thought it was, and it's not until I got on the other side of it. And that's my experience, and I can't tell you how many other people have had the same experience, you know? And I want to talk about a few of the steps, because a lot of times there's confusion about that. And first of all, I want to say I'm not an expert or an authority in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't think there is any such thing. I wasn't appointed or anointed. I'm just the guy who's here who's a sober alcoholic who's sharing his experience with you tonight. You're here to have your experience. Not mine. Not your sponsors, not your sponsees, but your experience. I got that experience through working the steps and through sponsorship. There's a lot of different paths, but I can only talk about my experience. And Alcoholics Anonymous is experiential. It is. Talking about it, theorizing it, is worthless. You know, people will get up here and they'll say things like, the Alcoholics Anonymous is for people that really want it, and somebody else say it's for people who really need it. Both of those are true. My experience is for people that do it. If you do the work will do you. I had a really crappy attitude for a long time. I now love Alcoholics Anonymous because I've had a transformative experience through the steps, despite my bad intentions and despite my uncompromising belief that they would not work. If you do them, they'll work. So let's talk a little bit about the fourth step. We get to the fourth step in the book, and Michael takes me to page 65. And there's a lot of different programs and guides you can use, but I'm a wordsmith. I'm a kind of a pain in the butt. You know, he wants to keep it simple right out of the book. He's, look, you notice anything about page 65? You know, that's where the three columns are, if you're not that familiar with it. I'm looking at him, I'm saying, no, not really. He goes, well, look again. I look at it again. Well, that Mr. Brown is a real jackass. Somebody needs to tighten him up. He says, no. No, do you notice that there's not even complete sentences there? I said, well, yeah, I see that. He goes, look, for you, I want you, for each one of those columns, to use, you know, two or three words, maybe five words at the most. I don't want a lot of writing here. I want, you know, I want for the person, institution, or the principle that you're resentful at, just write it down, two or three words. For the cause, two or three words. For the condition or how it affects you, the third column, you've got self-esteem, pocketbook, security, personal relations, sex relations, you know, just write it down. I'm prepared for a long talk. You can fill in the blanks later. And then I want a fourth column. There's not a fourth column in the book, but if you look on page 67, it says, you know, referring back to our list, we're going to identify mistake, fault, or blame. And he said, it doesn't say my fault. And it doesn't say my part. It says mistake, fault, and blame, not my part. And he said, it's a perfectly good shorthand, but a lot of people will get to that, and they'll think that they have to have a part in both the cause and the condition, and we don't necessarily always have a part in the cause and the condition. I have no idea what the hell he's talking about. I'm just trying to follow directions, right? Later he told me that what happens sometimes is you've got like a woman who's been raped. You know, she goes to the grocery store, it's 10 o'clock at night, she gets raped because she goes out to a car, some guy assaults her, rapes her, little kid maybe gets molested by a priest or an uncle or whatever. They come into Alcoholics Anonymous 5 years later, they're supposed to find their part. I have to find my part in that? This is BS. The reality is, if you use the term my part, we always have a part in at least the condition, but not always the cause. But it's hard to see that, and that's why the book talks about mistake, fault, and blame. And then you're going to list your character defects. You're going to selfishness, self-centeredness, self-seeking, dishonesty, pride, greed, lust, anger, gluttony, envy, sloth, fear. And like it says on the bottom of 66 and 67, the unwillingness to accept that another person is a child of God who could be spiritually sick, the unwillingness to forgive someone. You know, it talks about the prayer to the sick man on page 67. Then we're going to do the fear inventory. We're going to do the sexual misconduct inventory. It says it should take you a few weeks. It took me about 5 weeks. Took me two and a half weeks to think about it, two and a half weeks to do it. Because the book says it's simple but not easy. The simple is the black part. The not easy part is my ego, which separates me from you and from God. The latter is actually impossible, but the former is possible and quite painful. Quite painful. So I finally get this inventory done. And for the people that are relatively new, I'm going to tell you the first person on my inventory, just so you understand how simple this is. I'm resentful at, two words, my father. The cause, two words, deserted me. Third column, how does it affect me? What is the condition? Self-esteem, pocketbook, security, ambition, personal relations, sex relations. I mean, as you know, my grand sponsor, Scott Redman, used to say, it's a five-bagger. I mean, other than that, things are going pretty well. But, you know, it's consumed me for decades. What's my mistake, fault, and blame? Am I selfish, self-centered, self-seeking? I don't think so. Dishonest? No. Pride, greed, lust, anger, gluttony, envy, sloth. I write down anger. I was angry as a kid for a long time. I'm still angry. Fear. I got a lot of fear. What does the fear look like? I love my father, and in my mind, I gave him a certain amount of power. He abused that power. I will never let that happen again. There has to be a wall of insulation between you and me and you, because it's not safe for me. Now, that's a self-defense mechanism. It's not very good for marital relations or friendly relations or any kind of relations, but it's all I got. And then finally, I am unwilling to forgive my father. I'm unwilling to see him as a child of God who could be spiritually sick. So I write all this stuff down. I read it to Michael. I'm getting ready to go on to the next person, Mom. And Michael stops me. I don't understand that this is an interactive process, that, you know, he's going to be pulling stuff out of me. He goes, look, I want to make sure I understand this. You're resentful at your father, right? I said, yeah. He said, he deserted you, right? I said, that's right. And it affects everything. I said, that's right, Michael. And if I understand you correctly, you've got some residual anger, a lot of fear, and you don't want to forgive your father. And I'm like, yeah, Michael, and I've read ahead. I know there's a ninth step, and it's not going to happen. It's not going to happen. He's like, well, look, this is just the fifth step, okay? We're not there yet, but it's a program of honesty, willingness, and open-mindedness, and we're going to eventually get there. But I do have one more question. I'm like, all right, what's the question? He says, well, if I understand you correctly, you know, when you came to me that morning and asked me to sponsor you, and then we read the first time, well, you told me a little bit about your background, and you had this plan that you're going to use these passports, and you're going to go to Costa Rica, and you got a wife, and you got a kid, and you did not use the words, I'm going to desert them. But is there really a functional difference between what you were planning on doing and what your father did? My first thought was, this is not going the way I thought it was going to go at all. And I remember vividly, you know, putting my head down and muttering something like, well, I mean, if you look at it that way. And the people that have been around a while know that's why we admit to God, to ourselves, and to another human being in the fifth step, because I can't see me for myself. I have to have someone, in this case a sponsor, reflect me back to me. I didn't, you know. And so we go through this process, and I'm like, okay, all right. He goes, well, do you think you're any better than your father? I'm like, no, and thank you for pointing that out to me. We got through the rest of the inventory. I went home and I got quiet. We did 6 and 7. And 6 is a lot about willingness. 7 is a lot about humility. I have very little of either, but I'm trying to get through this process. Now I've got to make up an 8-step list. I make up the 8-step list. It's supposed to have my proposed amends to it. I come back. I show it to Michael. He says, your father's not on the list. I'm like, you're damn Skippy. I told you it wouldn't be on the list. He goes, well, you know, we close the meetings a lot with the Lord's Prayer. There's a clause in the Lord's Prayer. It goes like this: forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us. What do you think that means? Look, I think it's a damn trick question. That's what I think it means. You know, it's a spiritual truth. It's a maxim, right? And I appreciate it theoretically, okay? He says, well, you know, when we do the what's viewed as the 11-step prayer, you know, we say it is through forgiving that we are forgiven. I'm like, yeah, I believe that. I agree. He goes, well, are you willing to make amends? No. He goes, well, the 8th step is a lot about willingness. Are you willing to pray for the willingness? I said, yeah. He goes, well, okay, you pray, I'll pray, we'll pray. But meantime, start making amends. So I'm paying back the money. I'm making some of the social amends. I make amends to the wife. I am back in the big bed. I do not quite have the crossover privileges that I think I deserve. But, you know, things are going better, right? But I'm not making amends to my dad. I got this active 10-step process. I'm doing an evening review. I'm looking at it in the morning. I'm trying to make amends promptly. And by the way, when I was new, promptly was about 3 weeks. Now it's much more compressed in time frame. I'm talking to my sponsor about this. I'm going cycling back through in 6 and 7 through this 10-step process. I'm praying and meditating. I'm trying to get a conscious contact with this thing, this God that I don't quite understand. And I'm trying to practice the principles in all my affairs in step 12, and I'm trying to carry the message. You know, guys are asking me to sponsor. I'm taking them through the steps. I've taken guys through the steps. They're getting a year. You know, multiple guys are getting a year, but I'm not making amends to my father. This went on a number of years, and then I made I talked to my sponsor all the time. I screwed up. I said, Michael, I'm going up to Anchorage. I'm going to do some depositions for a trial. He just lights up like a Christmas tree. He goes, man, that's great. You'll make amends to your father. And I had forgotten that I told him my father's living in Wasilla, Alaska, which is about 30 miles outside of Anchorage, right? So now I'm trying to wave him off. I'm like, no. You're connecting two unrelated dots. That's not what's going on. I'm just going to go do I'm not ready. I've been praying. No. He says, no, you're praying. I'm praying. Everybody's praying. God's talking. Don't you hear him? I'm like, no, I'm not getting the memo. I'm not getting it at all. He goes, look, get quiet. I know you get quiet every morning. You pray and meditate. Brant talked about it. And I did. And over a few days, it came to me. I need to do this. I don't know what I'm going to do, but I'll do it. So I told Michael, I said, okay, I'll do it. What do I do? He goes, man, I don't know. I'm not going up there. Talk to God. Now, I used to derisively refer to my sponsor as the cosmic cupcake, the mystic muffin. I mean, it was unbelievable. When we first started talking about God, he reminded me that in Alcoholics Anonymous, if you have a spiritual practice or a religious belief in Alcoholics Anonymous, we encourage you to go further with it, to do it. We have no conflict with that whatsoever. If you got a problem drinking, we suggest you lay the steps over the top of it. But as far as your religious or spiritual practice, you know, go forth, do that. And if you have a problem with God, he said, why don't you look at it as a placeholder for an experience you haven't had yet? I'm like, what are you talking about? He says, well, it's just a word. You'll see creative intelligence, universal mind, higher power, all these different words. At one point in the book, Bill refers to him as my newfound friend, capital F. Don't you want a friend? And I'm like, maybe. I don't know. You know, it's just, but I think he's trying to trick me. And he says, well, do you like music? I said, yeah, I like music. He says, what kind of music do you like? I said, I like blues and rock. He goes, well, would you try to convince somebody that like classical music or punk rock to listen to your music? I said, no, obviously you like the music you like. He goes, exactly. That's just like Alcoholics Anonymous. We're just telling you to find the rhythm and harmony that you can get in tune with the infinite with. We're not suggesting what it is. Again, cosmic cupcake, mystic muffin. I mean, I have no idea what he's talking about, but it sounds good. It sounds good. His answer to all problems was God. And I thought he was crazy until I realized that the simpler the answer is, the purer the answer is. And that is the answer. You know, and I sponsor a lot of guys. I got guys who are Catholics, Protestants, guys who converted back and forth. I've got Jewish guys, Buddhist guys. I got a Jewish guy who likes Buddhism. He refers to himself as a Buju. It's all good. It's all good. We're good with that. You know, I got guys who have this Walt Whitman concept. They walk through the woods. A lot of guys that are surfers, you know, they view the ocean as this cosmic force. We don't tell you what to find. We just suggest that you seek, and if you seek, you'll find. So I'm going to go see my father, right? And I call him, and he says he'll see me. I fly up to Anchorage. I don't know what I'm going to do. And I see him across the room, and he's older than I remembered, and he's shuffling towards me. He's hesitating. I, on the other hand, am striding towards him with purpose. I'm not sure what the purpose is, but I've made a commitment. I'm going to do this. And when I got up to my father, I did one of the things that I hated. When I first got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I hated all the huggy-huggy, kiss-kiss, you know, I hated that. And without thinking, I grabbed my father and I hugged him. And he buried his head in my shoulder and he cried. And he cried for about 5 minutes and I cried for about 5 minutes and forgiveness occurred and all I had to do was show up and get out of the way. And if it doesn't make any sense to you, it's just because you haven't gone through the process yet. It's interesting. We ask for and we pray for guidance and direction. And what happens usually is very rarely do we get the burning bush, you know. Very rarely does God say, this is my son or my daughter in whom I'm well pleased. A lot of times we're at a meeting and some guy that we don't particularly care for that shares the same crap every day shares the answer. And if I just pay attention and listen to it and stay right here, right now, I can hear it. Or I'm at the grocery store and two kids are arguing about the candy and that's the answer. And we're talking about having a spiritual awakening. And we wake up. But if you're like me, you like to take naps. And the key is to try to stay awake through the day. Not to just pray and meditate and say, okay, I got this, God. I'll check in with you at night because I got a ninth step. No, to be present throughout the day. To actually be here now. It's a lot of work, but it's incredibly fulfilling. And some days are better than others. That's just the way it is. And, you know, I got to tell you, I got a decent relationship with my father now. And is it perfect? No. But I don't have that bile in the pit of my stomach when I talk about my father. I've met my stepmom, and I've got a half-sister, and he's met my kids, and everything's okay. You know, and I went back down, and things got better with the wife, because a lot of this stuff is connected, and we don't even realize it. But I want to give you an idea of what it's like for me, kind of on a routine basis, just so you understand how Alcoholics Anonymous works in my life. And how a lot of times we talk about the alcoholic mind. I don't know if I'll ever get rid of the alcoholic mind. That's why it's so important for me to have a sponsor, to have a God of my understanding that I talk to, and frankly, to have a lot of sponsees that I report my behavior to, because sometimes they keep me in check better than anybody else. But I'm going to tell you about the biggest resentment that I had against my wife, and it's going to sound stupid and childish and petty because it is, but it's mine. And the thing about a delusion is, when you're in the delusion, you don't know it. You don't know it. And what's going on is I got a few years sober, and I'm sponsoring guys. I'm a man of God. Everything's going well. But my wife clearly does not appreciate all the hard work I've done for us. And I know this because she takes the trash and recycling, and she puts it on the stoop every night. So, you know, if you ever wonder where the Al-Anons are, just tell this story. And I got to tell you, for you Al-Anons out there, and I love you guys, but I just want you to know something. If it weren't for us, you wouldn't even have a reason for existence, okay? Yeah. We give you purpose. No, actually, I love Al-Anons. I think it's... And it's interesting because they're everywhere. We can't get rid of them. You know, you might as well just embrace them. And I got to tell you, people that make poor taste Al-Anon jokes, that's stupid. It really is. You should think about it. You know, frankly, it's like the person that gets up the podium and says, "I'm a recovering Catholic." Because what you're telling to the new person, if they're Catholic, is maybe it's not okay that I'm Catholic. Okay, or some guy who's in Alcoholics Anonymous who's having a problem that also needs to go to Al-Anon, and we make a joke about Al-Anon. Well, we can't go to Al-Anon, you know, and that's incredibly destructive, and it's completely wrong. It's just not my experience at all in Alcoholics Anonymous or Al-Anon, and, you know, frankly, some of the people that do the steps in their purest form are Al-Anons, frankly, because they have to. They don't have an option sometimes. But I got this resentment against my wife. And I'm writing inventory about this trash recycling, and I'm talking to Michael, and Michael says, "Well, have you talked to her about it?" I'm like, "Well, no, I haven't talked to her about it." "No." He says, "Well, you know, you might have it wrong." And I said, "Michael, I know you think that way. But I've been married at the time for like 12, 13 years, and I got to tell you, I know what Lynn," that's my wife's name, "I know what Lynn's thinking before she's thinking it." And he says, "Well, you know, we call that mind reading, and it's a pretty significant character defect." But if you're not willing to accept that or look at that, you're going to have to pray and ask for guidance and direction, because resentment's the number one offender. It's not a big deal. It'll just kill you. So I'm praying and meditating. I'm asking God for direction. And what comes to me after a few weeks, not months, is patience, tolerance, love, and understanding. We hear it everywhere we go. It's all over the book. It's all over our literature. But I finally get it. I ask for it. I get it. I got patience, tolerance, love, and understanding. I got the trash recycling. I'm good. I'm a man of God. No problem. And by the way, I'm going around telling the guys that I sponsor what good work I've done here. I have a little problem with spiritual pride that I haven't figured out yet, right? And I go through this process, and this goes on for another, I don't know, 5, 6, 7 years. We get a dog, Zoe, golden retriever. The dog poops. I take her out in the morning. She poops. I put it in a bag. I throw it in the trash. On nights like tonight, if I'm at a meeting, the dog will go in the backyard, she'll poop. My dog, you know, my wife will go out and pick up the dog poop, but does she put it in the trash? No. She puts it with the trash and recycling on the stoop. So I'm talking to Michael, and I'm like, I'm spiritual and all, but now I got dog crap. I got dog crap, Michael. I got dog crap. I mean, come on, I got dog crap. He goes, well, what's the difference? I go, it's dog crap. That's the difference, it's dog crap. I know. Well, have you talked to her about it? Well, no, I haven't talked to her about it. He goes, well, you have to ask God for guidance and direction. So I ask God for guidance and direction. I have patience, tolerance, love, and understanding. I pay for it. I get it. No problem. Now I got the trash, recycling, and poop. This goes great. I'm doing this for, I don't know, 5 or 6 years. Everything's cool, right? And I'm telling all the guys I sponsor what great work I've done, right? Yeah. So a few years ago, I go out the front door instead of the side door. I don't get the trash, recycling, and poop. I feel guilty. You know, it's a Monday night. My home group is the Hermosa Beach Men's Stag. I'm going to go to my home group here, and I got to clean this up before I do this. So I go home, and I'm having dinner with the wife and the girls, and I wait for the right moment, and I'm like, you know, hey, honey, you probably noticed that I went out the front door instead of the side door. I didn't get the trash, recycling, and poop this morning. She's like, what? I'm like, okay, I've been taught to pause when agitated, all right. I'm like, baby, you know, the trash, recycling, and poop. You know, I've only been getting it for over a decade. And, you know, I didn't get it this morning. I know it's my job, and, you know, I'll do better next time. She goes, what are you talking about? So now I slow it down real slow, which, by the way, guys, they love that. They love that. I go through the whole process again, and she looks at me. She gives me that look that I've gotten from her so many times, like, are you out of your mind? And she says, Steve, you know we have possums and raccoons, and they're in the backyard by the trash and recycling bins, and we've even had coyotes come down from Palos Verdes. They've taken some of the small dogs, and, you know, it's kind of scary. I don't like to go out there at night, so I put the trash, recycling, and poop on the stoop. I figure I'll get it in the morning, or the girls will get it, or you'll get it, but I don't leave it out there for you. So I'm not that quick on the uptake, as you can tell from my talk tonight, but I realized that for well over a decade, I've had a resentment that has no basis in fact whatsoever. So I look at my wife, and I'm like, I love you, babe, I gotta go, you know, because I'm not gonna have this conversation with her. I go to my home group, because, right, they'll have sympathy, right? Right, they'll be, right, new. All the old timers are dragging me around. Hey, listen to what Lamb did. Go ahead, tell them what you did. Tell them. You know, and I'm like, oh, my God. And they're all laughing because we're a constant source of amusement. We're a divine distraction, you know. And I'm talking to my sponsor, and my sponsor's just cracking up, you know. He's like, well, yeah, there's good news and bad news. I'm like, okay, what's the bad news? He goes, the bad news is it never ends. I'm like, well, what's the good news? He said, well, the good news is this is Alcoholics Anonymous. Not only is there always something to do, but there's somebody to do it with, and that's how we roll in Alcoholics Anonymous. If you're new, I hope you find that person soon. Thanks for having me here.